Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today, I want to introduce you to the man who changed the world with his revolutionary engineering. He built 1,200 miles of roads, 37 docks and harbours, 17 canals, and the pioneering Menai Bridge. He was Thomas Telford. And in the studio with me, I'm joined by the former government special advisor on transport and speechwriter for David Cameron, who's just published a best-selling biography of Telford. Julian Glover, many thanks for coming in.
Hello.
Welcome to Meet the Writers. This is a huge book in scope and ambition. Actually, in physical size, it's quite heavy. As I know, I've carried it through several countries with me. And a wonderful companion, as we can see by the fact that it's definitely in the bestseller list.
That's right. You haven't put people off by saying it's too heavy, but, and there is an electronic version available and an audio one too, but I like the hardback with the cover of the great aqueduct that Telford built in Wales in the early 19th century, one of the first great iron structures.
What drew you to him as a subject?
Partly that he's been overlooked. Telford isn't forgotten. There's a new town named after him in Shropshire. He's remembered in Shropshire, a county in the west of England that he did a lot of work in. So he's not entirely forgotten, but he's a little bit overlooked. His whole period is a bit overlooked. When I was working for politicians, we'd do speeches and they'd talk about the great Victorian engineers, people like Brunel and the Stephensons. And we had the spirit of the 19th century being the go-to can-do Britain. But I think it was the 18th century. I think it was the Industrial Revolution, a period that Britain went from being a largely rural society to becoming one that had cities growing, had industry, had new forms of transport, new technology, steam, iron, really exciting period. Thomas Telford was at the core of that. But his role has been a bit overlooked. We just remember the Victorians. So I wanted really to bring the period before the Victorians alive.
Mm-hmm. Because, as you say, there was no better moment to be born. If you wanted to change the world by building things, then Britain in the second half of the 18th century was the time, really.
It was such an exciting period. The 18th century had so many conflicting things going on. It was, of course, a period of great art in Britain and country houses and the sort of National Trust tea rooms that we go and see at weekends today. But it was also the period that really smashed the old age. It created new things. It used new forms of energy. It turned Britain into a global power. It led to an empire. It led to a new form of Europe. We had revolutions. We had change. It wasn't a boring period. It was a period of absolute transformation. It was the period, really, when our modern country was made.
Well, let's go and focus in on Telford's life a little bit more, because he came from a very lowly ancestry, if you like. Tell me about his early life.
Yeah, so one of the fascinations for me about Telford was this life story. The book isn't really a book about engineering. I'm not an engineer. It's not about how to build a bridge. Other people are better at building bridges than me. But it is the story of an extraordinary life. And he was born, as you say, very humble background in the Scottish Borders, not the Highlands, the sort of romantic Highlands of Scotland that people know, or Edinburgh, Glasgow, but further south, right on the border with England, in a very quiet, very rural area that hasn't changed very much. He was born in 1757 at a farm where the track runs out at the farm today, just as it did then. And after that, there's just hills and wilderness. And he wasn't the farmer's son. He was the son of a labourer who just happened to work on the farm. And when he was 6 months old or so, his father died. His mother was kicked out of the farm because the job went, and so they didn't have a home. They had to go and stay with relatives. And he grew up in this little valley, off a little valley, near the River Esk, a river which is still beautiful, which he loved. He wrote poetry about it later in life. He always went back to Eskdale. He was very rooted in the place, and that's one of the attractions. He didn't run away from Eskdale. He was an Eskdale boy, as he called himself. And he grew up. He became a stonemason, an apprentice stonemason in his early teens in the local town, having to help build bridges and doors.
And he'd had a very good education too. The village school was quite egalitarian.
Yeah, he had an extraordinary education, and that might be part of the fact that he was just by a few miles a Scot, not an Englishman. In Scotland, there was a tradition of good education for everybody. It wasn't probably quite as good as some people nostalgically like to think. But in this valley, there was a really great little school, and it had a teacher. We don't know much about the teacher, but it had a teacher who was clearly very able. He taught the grandest family in the valley. Their sons went there, and Telford, the humblest, went there too. And they all played together. They fought games together. There's great descriptions of the sort of extraordinary childhood. And it must have driven these people on, because out of that little valley and the Westerkirk school, I think five of them got knighthoods. They went into imperial service. One of them guarded Napoleon on St. Helena. They were a bundle of energy, exploiting the best that the engineering and the empire had to offer people, military success. And from that, Telford must have gained confidence, and he gained knowledge, because he wasn't an ignorant person. He read books. There's these wonderful stories as a shepherd boy. He was supposed to have sat on the hills and read Paradise Lost whilst looking after his lambs. And I don't know if that's true, but it was too romantic not to hope it to be true. And he certainly read. And he wrote letters all his life, all the time, always about books he was reading. He was interested in science, mathematics, literature. He loved Jonathan Swift. So he had a compass that spanned so many things. Perhaps today we see engineering as a very mathematical, very precise thing, quite separate from the artistic world. Telford didn't have those boundaries. Of course, civil engineering was only just coming into being. The word civil engineering really meant it wasn't military, because before that, all engineers were military people. He thought, if it's interesting, I'll be part of it. Mm. And he darted around. So he became the stonemason. He worked his way up. And then he ended up slowly trying to train himself as an architect. It was a long time before he became an engineer.
Mm-hmm. You worked on the reconstruction of Shrewsbury Castle. Now, what led to that?
He was lucky, and lots of people who succeeded in the 18th century were lucky, that he had a good connection. He had patronage, and that was key to success for most people. You couldn't just apply for a job advertised in a newspaper or go to work in an office. You had to have somebody who picked you out and thought, oh, they're quite good, I'll give them a chance. And that person happened to be from the same valley as him, the Pulteney family, as it was by the time he got the help, or the Johnson family, as they were known. One of the Johnson sons married into the Pulteney family, and they were, by some fortunate chance, related to amongst the richest families in Britain, and they inherited the money. It was a slightly tortuous way, but he suddenly ended up being this very rich man, including the owner of Shrewsbury Castle and quite a lot of land in Shropshire, and a lot in Bath in Somerset. So this Pulteney Bridge is the famous bridge in Bath, which Robert Adam worked on. And Telford did various things in London first. He came to London, worked on Somerset House, the great structure by the Thames, as a labourer. And then he worked at Portsmouth Dockyard, designing a house for the Navy. He was working his way up, but the real break was Shropshire. And Pulteney said, come to Shropshire and do a bit of design work, a bit of repair work, oversee things on my castle, which he did. He moved into the castle and started putting Shrewsbury Castle as his address on the letters. I think he was very proud of it. And he designed a few new rooms in the castle, fitted them up, restored a bit of it, built a tower, which is still there, just next to Shrewsbury Station in the grounds. And that was his break, because suddenly he was in a county that was happening, again, like a microcosm, really, of Britain. It was going from being a very rural county, quite staid. Shrewsbury was a medieval town with crumbling bridges and crumbling gateways. Suddenly, Shropshire was the birthplace of industry. Iron was being smelted there. All sorts of things were happening. So Telford was in the right place, and he used the opportunity of being in Shropshire to expand his horizons.
Mm-hmm. He became the county surveyor, didn't he?
Yeah, and that sounds a slightly boring job, but of course it gave him the right to interfere in everything and be asked to come and solve problems in everything. And I think it helped he was an outsider, because if you're in a small location and there's battles about doing things and you're part of the long-standing battles, you have one side or the other supporting you. And Shropshire was absolutely riven politically. There was the Clive family and the Pulteney family, and others were really battling it out. He was the outsider who was just useful. And he quite quickly danced in and built country houses. We don't know which one, but there's a record of him working on one. Built churches, which are still there. There's a beautiful church on a crag at Bridgnorth he designed. Studied classical architecture in order to do it. Fixed up bridges. Brought his friends down from Scotland. This man had so much energy. It's extraordinary. One of the daunting things about Telford and writing his life, and the daunting thing I think that put many people off writing about him before, although there have been books, but not so many, is he did so much. It's very hard to focus. It's very hard to say what Telford was. He didn't, you know, he was a church architect as well as an engineer. He was a poet as well as a bridge builder. He built canals, he built roads. He did all sorts of things. He was almost a politician. He worked in Westminster to get approval for his schemes. So that great life of just achieving endless numbers of things began really in Shropshire, where he suddenly had some friends who he was friends with, the Darwins. I have no record that he met the young Charles Darwin, but he certainly knew the father very well and was in Shropshire back and forth and still county surveyor at the time that Charles was born, so he probably did meet him. Mm. But they suddenly found some Roman ruins outside Shrewsbury. It was a well-known site called Roxter, and they found a mosaic floor. So Telford turned himself into an early archaeologist and excavated the site. Said he used some prisoners from the Shrewsbury jail to come and help do the digging. He mapped it and properly recorded the stratigraphy and the design of it in a way that archaeologists hadn't done very much before, because they were just there to find gold and objects. So he published some of the earliest archaeological drawings. He seemed to be able to do almost anything. It's extraordinary. And one of the reasons is he didn't seem to take time off. He worked very hard. He stayed up late into the night doing his letters. And he did it over his whole life for more than 70 years.
Mm. One of his great achievements was, I can't pronounce the name of it because it's Welsh, but his aqueduct.
Yeah, the Pont Cysylltu, which I can't pronounce properly either, but it's something like that. It's a stunning thing. And that was the moment he became an engineer, really. In the 1790s, Britain was at war with France. There was a sort of national, after 1792, we sort of took on the revolution, or they took us on. And Telford suddenly saw the opportunity in engineering, in new things, the use of iron, the sort of desire to power a military economy. He worked on canals. He became the engineer of a canal near Shrewsbury and built one of the world's first iron aqueducts, a very short one, but an interesting structure, which is still there, marooned in a field now because the canal has been taken away. And that gave him the opportunity to get involved in a much bigger project called the Ellesmere Canal, which absolutely stretches away across the Midlands. It's a complex network. But one of the things it has is an aqueduct across the River Dee. It's a very beautiful site. It was intended to be beautiful. It's a huge piece of daring design. Nothing like it had ever been built before. Telford wasn't the only person involved. He brought his friends from up in the borders, came down to help construct it, and he worked with a more experienced engineer called William Jessop. But he got the glory, and some people have said Telford edged Jessop out of the way. Whether he did or not, he was behind it. He got the courage to put this thing up. Mm. And it's still there. It's unchanged today. It still holds water and it's still in use. It's an absolutely stunning structure. And people flocked from around Europe once the war had stopped and around Britain to come and see it. It was very famous. Wordsworth, poets, Walter Scott called it the stream in the sky.
One of his greatest challenges also concerns a canal, the Caledonian Canal. Not so great for him.
That was later in his career. And by this point, he was a really established engineer. He was the person who had the respect to build great projects with the work of the government. And the government wanted to build a canal across the top of Scotland. If you look at a map of Britain, it's quite tempting. There's a bit where it sort of narrows down above the Highlands, near Inverness. Loch Ness and some other lochs fill much of the gap with water. So you only need about 20 miles of canal to link it all up. And it doesn't climb too high. So it's incredibly tempting to put a canal there. And it had been proposed in the 18th century. Telford ended up being the person who oversaw the project. And far from being an easy thing, it became an absolute nightmare. The idea was that it would be a big canal, not a little one like we have in much of England. It was big enough to take navy ships, so by the time it was finished, the navy ships had got even bigger and didn't fit. And they could sail and avoid going around the top of Scotland where they might have met the French. It was another military project in part. But it took 20 years to build, and when it opened, it wasn't deep enough, and it was very hard to construct because it was remote and the skills weren't there and they had to invent new things. And at each end, connecting it to the sea turned out to be very complex. In the Inverness end, there's a huge mud flat, a kind of shallow tidal sea, and linking a canal into the sea through the mud, it's a very unglamorous task. It's a very difficult one, and it took them a decade of just piling stuff up to get some firm foundations. And imagine doing that in the cold, in the rain, in the Highlands, in a town, Inverness, which even today people think is a little bit remote, but it's easy enough to get there. But then it took a very long time. There were no bridges. You had to ford rivers, catch ferries. And they sent the engineers up there, and they were stuck there for 2 decades. And Telford travelled repeatedly to the scheme, at least twice a year, and often more than that. So he was very involved, and he knew the problems. But again, it did get built, and it's still there today, and it has at last found a use. It's full of yachts going back and forth, and it's very beautiful. Mm. But gosh, it was hard.
As you say, much of what he built still there today, and this the so-called disaster of the Caledonian Canal, although ultimately successful, did come much further on in his career. But in the preceding 30 years, of course, he had just built masses of stuff. I mean, he basically invented our road network.
He did, up to a point. He invented the best roads. I mean, Telford was a perfectionist. And one of the things I like about him was he didn't want to build second best. So when he built an iron aqueduct, it was amazing. When he built the Caledonian Canal, it was massive. When he built the road from London to Holyhead, another political road, because MPs in Ireland, when the Irish House of Commons was abolished at the start of the 19th century and the United Kingdom came into being with the Westminster Parliament bringing everybody together, all those MPs had to travel to London and they didn't like the old rather dreadful tracks, took the journey, so they got the government to fund a scheme. And it was the best road ever built, really. It was effectively the first motorway. It was a wide, smooth, very level. Everything on it was designed to the same pattern. So all the way through North Wales, through Snowdonia. And again, that's still there. And you can see many of the structures and the gates and toll houses. It was a very model road. He didn't, however, build everything. And one of the things Telford did or was accused of doing is building very expensive things and very elaborate things that had to have government backing. Other engineers built much more cheap and cheerful roads with private backing. There was a network of toll roads in Britain called the turnpikes, which began in the mid-18th century. Little stretches of local schemes with a parliamentary act that could take over a road that had previously just been possibly a track or just maintained by the village. And they had a rougher surface. Telford was very disapproving of those people. One of them, the McAdam family, who gave their name in the end to tarmac, although they didn't make tarmac. Tarmac is a different thing, but that preserved their reputation. They piled rocks onto mud and called it a road surface, and Telford thought that wasn't suitable. And there was all sorts of battles between them. Select committee hearings in Parliament when Telford would come and give his evidence as to why his schemes were better. And they were better. They were also more expensive.
You mentioned his poetry and his personal life. Now, I know that he was good friends with the eventual poet laureate, Robert Southey, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that relationship and also about Telford as a poet.
The 18th century, I think, was a time when more people wrote poetry than they do today. Even so, it was pretty extraordinary that Telford, as a shepherd boy and then a stonemason in Langham, a little town up in the borders, was writing poetry and actually got his first poems published when he was about 21 years old in an Edinburgh magazine. It must have been quite an astonishing thing for other people in the town to see this. And they weren't terrible. I mean, he's not a great poet. I wouldn't put him at the level of a sort of national poet for Scotland. But they were good pieces of honest prose, very influenced by the writing of other 18th century people like Pope. You can tell the influences. And what's charming about them is he describes his love for the place he comes from, and he describes the hills and the sheep and the burbling River Esk. And he does all that not as some London grandee who's pretending to be romantic and dreaming of sheep on the hills, but actually as the person who's out there guarding them. So it's a voice of a real person. And in that, he certainly later in his life got to know Southey and some other writers and poets in London. It's never clear that he met Wordsworth, but though he was certainly, Southey knew them well, and Coleridge as well. He was part of the sort of romantic movement attacked by Byron as the sort of the Lakers, the burbling voice of faux rusticism. But the really interesting connection is with Burns. So Telford was born a little bit before, 4 or 5 years before Burns, and not so far to the east. Burns was up in Ayrshire, but not too far away. And Telford loved Burns's writing when he found it and encouraged him and wrote to him. And the poems of Telford's were in Burns's ownership when Burns died. He wrote a long poem about Burns's death. And there's a letter which suggests he knew Burns. It's written to the landlord and talks about my friend Rabbi. So the question is, did they meet? And there's no proven evidence they did. But they certainly knew of each other and had a mutual respect. And in a way, he saw in Burns a much greater writer who could really be the voice of the Scottish rural poor in a way that he couldn't, because he wasn't a good enough writer. And also he was busy making his way as an engineer and an architect. Although he did publish his own poems later when he had a bit of money in Shropshire. He did a bound edition of his poem on the Esk, which he gave to friends. I think he always felt it was a bit of a whim rather than a great piece of writing. I don't think he ever had any false illusions about his quality. He would send poems he wrote in the evening after working to his best friend, Andrew Little, who would write back, apparently saying, they're not quite right, or try changing that. And he fiddled all his life with the work he did. So there's different versions of poems which he would give to friends, and you could see they've changed.
Do you think that there was a relationship between him and Little?
I don't think in the sense we would understand it today. It's very hard to know about Telford's private life. He didn't have a wife. He didn't marry. He didn't have children. He didn't seem to have a family of any kind. He didn't have a home till his mid-60s. But he did have a very close, at least literary, relationship with Andrew Little, who was a school friend from the Valley, became a school teacher, was blinded in service at sea, and became a teacher back in Langham. And the letters between them, at least we have Telford's letters. We don't have Little's letters. They're incredibly intimate. They were very, very fond of each other. Whether there was more to it, you can't say. You could speculate, but there is no evidence. But he certainly wasn't a typical 18th century, early 19th century man on the make who would have got married, would have probably bought a small country house somewhere in Surrey and probably tried to stand for Parliament and wipe out memory of his background. Telford was very proud of where he came from, and his best friends were always from there. He was certainly unusual.
extremely unusual, and how wonderful that we are able to remember him now in this wonderful work. Very odd man, it would seem, as you say, no home really until much later on, moving around constantly, but the inventor of so much that we see today. And it's to that I want to go now, about to talk about how the infrastructure then compares to today, because of course you're uniquely qualified to look at that, having been a special advisor to the UK Department of Transport.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is, if you're trying to build stuff today, to think about how it was done before, how it shapes what we have today. And infrastructure is sometimes talked about, a word, of course, Telford wouldn't have known. It didn't really come into much use until the 1960s and 70s. But we often talk about it as a thing you just switch on. The government will say, we must invest in infrastructure. Donald Trump likes to say, America needs more infrastructure. Mm. Infrastructure isn't a sort of commodity. It's a thing that's rooted in place and history and linking populations. And you need to understand how it was built and created in the past to think of doing it right today. Countries that just impose it on themselves often get it wrong. You know, Spain has famously built airports with no planes. China is building stuff everywhere, much of it in the wrong place and not going to be used. And we need to have that historical knowledge. And when I was working in government, you could see some of the successes and some of the mistakes of the past shaping what we have today, trying to build new high-speed railways, which are often on a similar alignment to early ones. The very first railway from London to Birmingham is next to what we're going to have as high-speed too. And also trying to find some of that ambition, because it's certainly true that 100 years ago, 200 years ago, people were a bit more confident about just giving it a go and putting big stuff up. The road to Holyhead was just built. The Menai Bridge across, the first suspension bridge, the first large suspension bridge in the world, Telford oversaw, which is still there in North Wales. They just turned up and started building it. They did have an Act of Parliament, but they didn't have an endless debate about, was it the right kind of bridge? Should we be doing this? Should we have an environmental impact statement? Mm-hmm. Now we've got...
But they took care of the workers, didn't they? I mean, they were very...
He did. He was unusual in that. Yeah. He seemed, maybe because he had been a worker, he seemed to respect the safety of people on his projects in a way perhaps the bigger 19th century projects didn't always. Maybe the younger Brunel didn't always have such a great relationship with the people on his schemes. Today, we need to find a bit of that ambition. And it was interesting seeing projects like High Speed 2, seeing the debate about the third runway at Heathrow, an endless debate, and very little action. Or Crossrail being built under central London, which is now nearly complete, a brand new high-capacity railway right under the city, not too far from where we're sitting now, which is about to open. And I do think we can do things. Sometimes in Britain we have an anxiety that we can't make stuff happen, that other countries are good at this. Actually, we're not so bad, but we're not very good at talking about it.
Mm. Tell me about your role with... I know you were very involved with HS2, and of course it's been highly controversial.
So my role in government was as a political advisor to the Transport Secretary, and before that I worked for the Prime Minister. And that encompasses many things. You're helping write speeches, you're looking at documents, you're trying to check things aren't going to go wrong, you're trying to make things happen in the department and bring people together. You engage with the centre of government and other departments. There's a multiplicity of things you're supposed to do. And one of the things I was involved in was rail, because it's a very central part of what the government does. Unusually in Britain, we have what we call a privatised railway system, but is actually extremely state interfered with, much more than when it was nominally a state organisation and much more independent. And part of the plan is to build this big new railway out of London, heading north. We've built a high-speed line down to the Channel Tunnel and through to Europe quite easily a decade and more ago. And so the challenge with High Speed 2 is partly to overcome fears about what its impact will be, partly to make sure it stays on cost, and partly to get the design right. And obviously, I wasn't responsible for the design, but I was responsible for sort of helping link the High Speed 2 organisation to the government and meeting people and talking about what's going to happen. And we had to get the legislation through Parliament to do it. That's just happened for the first phase. It's now Act of Parliament, which will allow the construction of the line. Telford used Act of Parliament too for many of his projects, particularly the canals. And they passed in a few weeks. The High Speed 2 bill took several years. It's a much more complex process. So helping oversee that as well was interesting. The challenge now will be to build it on cost and to get the design right. And if I have one anxiety, it's that there's still a challenge about how it's going to fit into the places it serves, how it's going to connect to the existing transport network, because there's no point having a massive, high-capacity, super-fast, super-reliable transport system if you can't get on it. And that'll be a challenge not just in London, where there's going to be a lot of passengers coming off. It links to Crossrail very neatly at Old Oak Common, so that'll be an easy transition. But also in Birmingham, where the station is in the middle of Birmingham, but not at this place where the current station is, so we need to work that out. And then also how it will flow through further north. It's going to be built in phases, but the first phase, the trains will run off it onto the current network. So trains to Scotland, trains to Manchester will get quicker, Liverpool, right from the opening of High Speed 2, but they've got to get those interfaces right and make sure that the old railway and the new railway align themselves well. So I was involved in all of that, and of course making the case for it, because there was a lot of objections. Nonetheless, Parliament has approved it. The government says it's funding it. I'm not involved now, so we'll see what happens.
And of course, none of this really would have happened unless wonderful engineers like Thomas Telford had laid the groundwork.
That's right. And I think engineers get a bit forgotten at times. They're not very good at shouting about what they do. Perhaps today, by necessity, it's such a specialised world. You have to be a consulting engineer on one thing. You don't do it all. Nobody really oversees the whole of one project as an engineer. You need people who can come in with all their skills. So there isn't now a figurehead. There isn't those great, glorious people who just get muddy. And the Brunel photograph with the chains in the background and the stovepipe hat and the cigar, the classic look that he cultivated deliberately. He wanted to be a celebrity engineer. We don't have celebrity engineers now in the way we might have celebrity cooks or other things. And perhaps we need them. Perhaps we need to see that there are extraordinary careers that people can have. One of the great things about Crossrail, the scheme in London, has been that it's run a very strong apprenticeship program. It's brought in lots of young people, many women, not just men, who've come in and got incredible skills and had an extraordinary experience and now well-placed to build great careers. On projects in Britain, there's a brand new sort of sewer that's going to be tunneled under the Thames, a huge, huge project. Lots of people are transiting to that or going off to Dubai to work on things there. So the careers are extraordinary, but they're not always well known. And people say, I want to be a lawyer or I want to be a journalist. They don't often say, I want to be an engineer, partly because it's hard. You have to learn. You have to have skills. But when you get it right, it can be incredible.
Yeah, well, and now, thanks to you, Julian Glover, we know much more about this wonderful engineer, Thomas Telford. Julian Glover's book, Man of Iron, is published by Bloomsbury. Thomas Telford and the Building of Britain. It's out now. Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Sam Impey, Claire Urban and Anthea Longo. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.